Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
These haters on my body, shake them all.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your completely non-presumptuous runway interruption of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
They say I got the juice, I got the sauce. These haters on my body, shake them all. Pussy, I'm a bully and a boss. I'm killing them, sorry for your loss. I just caught a body, Randy Moss. Now this year I'm really going north.
That's Young M.A. That's ooh. I'm here with a lot of oohs. I got Janique Maillard.
Hi.
Yeah, I did it. Program director, Kinfolk out in Brooklyn, and also an elegant writer. I've got Doreen Sanfelix.
Hello.
Writer at MTV News. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
I'm excited to have you guys here, for a number of reasons. One, because the thing that we're going to talk about involves Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Which is where we are all from. You guys both wrote about Young M.A. Nikki, I'm just going to call you Nikki now.
Yeah, see?
Just going to call you Nikki. Nikki, you interviewed Young M.A. recently. And yeah. Doreen, you wrote about Ooh and also some of the earlier records. Shouts to Henny and Hose.
Great record.
Can we say that here?
We just did. Young M.A., if you do not know, is a young rapper from Brooklyn who is in the middle of basically what feels like a classic New York rap radio explosion, which is a thing that obviously happens in all different cities with local rappers. It hasn't happened very often in New York recently. You have little flickers and moments here and there, but to have what feels like basically a mid to late 90s street rap record all of a sudden be like the biggest thing on New York radio is an unusual thing. You have Young M.A., you also have A Boogie, who I wrote about recently, who has a number of slightly off-kilter post-Drake, post-Bobby Shmurda records that are kind of kicking around radio. And it's really the first time I can think of, probably in the last 10 years, where young street rappers seem to be getting a lot of traction in this city. I mean, obviously you had an A$AP Rocky moment, mm-hmm. or you have weird French Montana just...
But those are glamour rappers. Those are glamour rappers.
You tell them that.
I mean, I love them. Yeah, I mean, I love them.
It's just a different
French
thing.
French is very much street.
Right.
Like, but I was listening to something of his the other day.
Was it Lockjaw?
No, it wasn't Lockjaw. It was a very old version he did of some song. It's so absurd that I can't think of it right now. But
it'll come back.
Yeah, but I mean, I think about the fact that, yeah, French Montana got shot in the head, but also, like, French Montana dates the Hollywood
Divorcees. And French, and actually French's sort of biggest records come with him as an accent piece.
Yeah.
He's like the Nate Dogg, basically, or like a version of the Nate Dogg. Whereas you now have these two young rappers who are basically making records that feel very familiar to me from growing up in the mm-hmm. city. Something that you both brought up in your pieces is open car windows, Brooklyn in the summer. Let's talk a little bit about that, because that feels very particular. Not that the people don't drive in other places or aren't in cars, but like when I think of hip hop and car culture in Houston, I'm thinking about slow drives around the freeway. When I'm thinking about the Bay Area, it's ghost riding. Here, it's people parked up with the windows open and speakers blasting. Let's talk a little bit about what this summer in Brooklyn was like.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, it's kind of crazy. I've been gone all summer, actually. I left.
Thanks. Okay, cool. So, Doreen.
I left in June for tour and came back in August. But the thing that I've always said is that New York car culture actually doesn't get enough rep, but that's because everyone thinks New York is Manhattan. Mm-hmm. If you live outside of Manhattan, mm-hmm. you drive.
Of course.
I still get rides to work from friends. Mm-hmm. I still get rides to the club from friends.
What neighborhoods did you... have you lived in?
Well, I grew up in East Flatbush, right. So I'm all the way on the south side. Mm-hmm. And basically anything further south of me, you drive. Mm-hmm. Like, you learn how to drive when you're 15, you get your license mm-hmm. when you're 16. It's yep. just like the Midwest. Same thing with people who live in the deep Bronx. Everyone who lives yeah. in Queens drives, period. That's yeah. not even a question. So I think that the New York car culture really doesn't get a lot of spotlight. And a lot of that is because of the fact that we haven't had music in so long. Mm-hmm. But I remember, like, all the mixtapes I've ever heard in my life, Dipset, you know, all mm-hmm. that stuff. I heard that in cars.
Yeah, of course.
In booming drug dealer sound systems. Mm-hmm. And, like, that is a huge part of what makes things hot. Because, like you said, there's a lot of the posting up in the summer mm-hmm. where it is, like, we're so close together that throwing a party on the block literally means, like, sitting yes. on the block. Mm-hmm. But I think that everyone I know in New York still does the car test. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's... I think it manifests itself differently in different cities. But I think that there is definitely... a huge part of being big in New York is being played in a car.
Yeah. Doreen, Canarsie is where you grew up?
Yeah, I grew up yeah. in Canarsie. Right. And I lived in Canarsie up until I went to college. So these areas of New York that you're talking about, Judnick, like Manhattan, the places that people make the avatar for larger New York City, to me, they were foreign. I didn't understand the stereotype that, oh, New Yorkers don't drive or New Yorkers don't have cars. It's mm-hmm. like I spent most of my life in a car. Mm-hmm. And in the summer, it's really interesting because it might feel like nostalgia, but it actually is the present day that cars create the borders in a city like Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Like, there's certain neighborhoods in Brooklyn, you don't hear music blasting from cars because the people who do that don't live there.
Right.
And so to me...
Or they've been pushed out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they've been more to the point. Out, yeah.
White people. So to me, you know,
shouts to all our listeners, by the way.
Don't worry, we'll share this to the people who need to listen. But, you know, I spent a lot of time in Flatbush.
Yep.
I was listening to the noise that's just always outside of my window. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being that Young M.A. was actually playing on a loop. So before Ooh mm-hmm. would finish, mm-hmm. Henny and Hoes would come on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, so it had become the atmosphere so much so that I didn't actually think to kind of like look her up for a minute. I was just like, you know what? This is the song of the summer.
It just is.
It just is.
Yeah.
And then
it very quickly took on this sort of air of inevitability.
Exactly.
I realized like probably around like 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago, like somewhere.
It was like right around the time I came back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, definitely. Like there was
just
a
right. There was just a moment where like you weren't hearing it all the time. And then it's like you woke up the next day and you were like, oh, this is just the wallpaper of the borough. And then the radio picked up on what was happening in the borough and it became the wallpaper on the radio.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, just this car culture conversation that we're having is very mm-hmm. interesting to me because Brooklyn, you know, if it were a city on its own, would be the fourth largest city in America. Mm-hmm. And then within that, there are so many sub-neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And I think about, you know, driving down Notion is not the same as driving down Flatbush, mm-hmm. is not the same as driving down Washington. But when everybody's listening to one of two radio stations that we have in the city, it does feel extremely local. It mm-hmm. feels very much like a village almost. Mm-hmm. Like there's this one message that's getting... transmitted no matter where you are in the like plethora of neighborhoods that Brooklyn has.
And also that particular thing, which is not unique to New York, but it does obviously with all of us growing up in Brooklyn feels that way where you like you pull up to a red light with your radio blasting and then the person in the car next to you is also on the same song, you know, and you feel like, oh, like I have found community
totally.
Here yeah. for these 30 seconds. Like we're in the sharing process.
And I think there's a huge part of it that comes from the radio culture, the fact that like, I grew up on the block. That's how I heard entire albums. Like
right.
before I was able mm-hmm. to buy rap albums, I knew entire rap songs and rap discographies mm-hmm. because people played them outside of my window. Mm-hmm. That was the thing. Like the radio is not necessarily played as much unless people are idly driving around and it's like, I don't want to think about what I'm going to play. But I remember like my friends always having mixtapes in the,
yeah.
you always had a mixtape. It was a Clue mixtape or whatever. You always had a mixtape. And I always remember like listening for who was listening to what station and also knowing what DJ was on the station based on what was being played. Mm-hmm. Ooh is a track that I expect to be played by like K Slay at 2 a.m.
Right.
You know what I mean? Old days, Hot 97. Mm-hmm. So when you hear that in the middle of the day and you're like, it's four, Flex is on, like what? What's going on? Like, it's crazy how that, like, it's written in the language of the city. You know what I mean? I know when you, I've watched so many New York records go from 2 a.m. records to 4 p.m. records.
Of course. And also, so two things. One, this is happening, obviously, in an internet-driven age where the thing where it used to take 6 months for a record to go from 2 a.m. to 2 p.m., now, because fan bases are so avid and so demonstrable, like you can identify the fan bases, that process has been collapsed. Also, it's a little strange, I think, and I think the internet is responsible for this as well. Hot 97 in particular, because it's the older of the two stations, has this sort of longstanding, I don't want to say antagonistic relationship to modern New York rap, but at least it's like an it's agonized in some way. Because at some point in the mid to late 2000s, Hot 97 decided, like, we're a rap, like, we're a global hip-hop station, and we're also an R&B station, and, like, increasingly in the 2010s, we're, like, an Iggy Azalea station. Like, you know, we're a station that...
Well, I think it was...
we're playing G-Eazy records. Like,
well, we forget,
point.
We forget, and, you know, I love that article that you wrote about how, like, white rappers don't need cosigns anymore, which is, like, what I've been screaming for, like, God knows how long, but it's, like... Everyone forgets that this, all of this happened because we as black stations decided to be inclusive. Remember when we, remember when NSYNC and Justin Timberlake got on 106 and Park? And we as black children felt like, okay, finally, like our channels aren't just shoving down our throats that we're black. They're finally not taking a monolithic approach to us, realizing that we are the internet generation. We do listen to pop music. We do like all this stuff. And so there was a lot of excitement when you started hearing those kind of records on Hot 97. But the problem with that is you have gargoyles up there. So it's like, if you're if the station is not growing with the music and the generation, and you got some real old stone age people up there complaining and beating down the very thing that they swear that they're fighting for, because I don't never see nothing positive come out their mouth about New York rap, then it's like, why did we do all of this? Like, we let this other music in to give people the idea to create places for a young MA, for someone who's like, I listen to all types of music, but I can still do the street bar thing. I can, I got bars, I got all this stuff. I can still put out, you know, this blasting out of Cars record, and but I'm still a kid of this generation. I'm just like, why did we do that? Like, what was the point of us allowing... for all of this, like, okay, we're more than one thing. We listen to this. Rap can be more than one thing. And now, even with her, even with Young M.A., when they're interviewing her, they're, like, fighting the idea of her as a it's, different person.
It's interesting because you, you sort of, I don't want to say that everybody gets the gatekeepers they deserve, but people become the gatekeepers that they believe they should be.
Right.
And so it's interesting to see New York radio right now on the one hand be like, oh no, we're for everybody, and then on the other hand all of a sudden have two rappers who are like just legit weird New York street rappers who have hits, but, and then have to also be the radio station that promotes this thing, which if you looked even 18 months ago was a fringe, like a fringe idea.
Absolutely.
And now all of a sudden it's like, oh, we have to be custodian of New York rap. We're not just the custodian of everything. We're also now doing the thing we did in 96. Like, then, this is future flavors, like, you know, all over it.
And in the case of Young M.A., it's interesting because she's a very slippery character. When I was researching her, I found out that she had been offered this role on Empire. So she could have been blown up in that very particular way, like somebody like Breezy from from Philadelphia. But she specifically chose not to do that. And every time, you're right, every time somebody's interviewing her, and most of the time those people are men, those gargoyles, their gender is male. They ask her these questions that don't actually pertain to anything that she's producing aesthetically. How do you feel about being a female rapper? That's not something that Young M.A. is really pressed about in any of her songs, or also just like in her swag, like in the way that she appears. You can feel that she's not troubled by the idea of what a female rapper should be, or what a female rapper should feel like they have to contend with. And then also being from New York and being specifically from Brooklyn, multiple places in Brooklyn, she, like with that freestyle, she's not interested in necessarily being an ambassador for the entire state or like our idea of what New York City is. It's very Brooklyn-centric.
Right.
And I think that's something that gets lost in our idea of what New York City street rap is because New York City is so segmented across boroughs, but also across gender, across so many, you know, borders, basically, that I'm just interested in the way that she flouts a lot of those
well, it's like
categories.
We just said, it's like we just said about the car culture, about like if you live in a certain part of the city, you know that everybody drives. Like when we were going to dance hall parties and all that stuff in Flatbush, your ride showed up to get you and your ride showed up at 2 a.m. And you were at the mercy of your ride and whatever time they finished work and however far they were coming or whoever else was getting picked up, and you weren't allowed to go home by yourself. There was a ride to make sure that everybody got home. So it's the same thing. It's like when I interviewed her, I really, this part was taken out of the interview, but I really loved it. I asked her what part of Brooklyn she's from, and she said she doesn't claim any part of Brooklyn specifically, one, because she listed all the streets that she's lived on and they're... She's literally lived in, like, the Ville, East Flatbush, which, like, unless you're from Brooklyn, you don't really understand how crazy that is to have lived in, like, those two different neighborhoods. But it's, like, she was saying how, like, everybody in New York is so territorial because they all want to be the king of this space. And they want their space to, like, rise with them, you know, your kingdom and all of that. And she's, like, it's really, it's part of the culture here. It's how we are as New Yorkers. But for her... Her story is Brooklyn. She can't claim one spot because she's never been, it wouldn't be authentic to do so. And she would be claiming a block that she probably spent a couple years on or a few years on or is on every other week. And I was telling her, like, that's so Brooklyn to me. Like, I grew up jumping from neighborhood to neighborhood. And there is definitely, like, segregation where people don't leave their neighborhoods, but they're... The people that come out of this city, or specifically out of Brooklyn, are always the people that slither through.
There's mobility in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And it's weird. I mean, maybe, I mean, look, this is purely anecdotal, but like there's, I think there's a tremendous amount of mobility within Brooklyn, and more so than there is between, say, Brooklyn and the Bronx, or Brooklyn and Queens. Like, you know, people are more apt to stay. If we're going to move, we're going to stay in Brooklyn as opposed to going to another borough. Like, there's something, there's some meta, I don't know if it's an identity or just, like, a comfort level where it's like, yeah, maybe we can go elsewhere in the borough. But
also, you can move anywhere and be different.
Right.
In Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You can move to a different neighborhood, and then you're a different class. People look at you a different way. There's different people living around you, different neighbors, different noise, like you said, different culture. So it's like, I don't really have to jump to another borough.
So basically your vibe with her is that she didn't feel overly preoccupied with when we think of, and of course it's telling them we think of King of New York conversations. You know, that's the conversation for the last 30 years. It's not Queen of New York. It's King of New York. But she doesn't seem overly preoccupied with that.
Not at all. But I don't think any of the women who are, to be fair, New York rap is being held up by women right now.
Yeah,
the greatest rapper out right now is a woman from Queens. Like, say what you want to say, but it's like New York rap wouldn't even have a narrative right now if it wasn't for women. In my mind, why be concerned?
Right.
You know, like Remy's not concerned. You know what I mean? Like these women are not concerned because when you're coming from, especially as black women, coming from a space where it's not just that it's not a safe space for you, there's not even an entryway for you. Where is the entryway for someone that looks like Young M.A.?
Right.
And that's what she said in the interview. She was like, I only know rap as two things. You're either a female rapper or you're a male rapper. And they look very specific. And so for her to even enter the game, she had to basically like create her own path. And so... It's just like women to do that. It's just like black women to do that, to carry the burden, to keep the story going, and to
invent the path.
Invent the path.
To stay independent. Yeah. That's something that's so important to her in every interview. Like she talks about that with you.
Oh, she's
not
sign.
About.
She's
isn't.
Sign.
And I don't think she's going to do that anytime
sign.
Soon.
I don't think so.
I think she's gonna sign.
But she's a hustler, so she may.
That's, I mean, yeah.
She'll hold out, though.
Yeah,
for
no,
the
it's
right.
no knock. It's
she's
no
gonna
knock.
get a good deal because she's a hustler.
Check. Yeah, she'll get a check.
Yeah,
and like we shouldn't frown upon it if that's how it ends up going.
I do appreciate and try to support the idea that artists can stay independent in this 2016 environment.
Let's talk a little bit about what it is about her records, and I assume you guys are listening to A Boogie as well, like what is it about those records that feel very specifically New York? Because especially in 2016, where everything feels kind of post-regional, everything feels like, oh, it's just some 17-year-old kid on the internet doing a thing and all of a sudden like everybody is doing it. What is it that's specific about what they're doing that allows us to sit here and actually kind of like revisit this narrative? Because I'll say like I've been at the paper for 8 years, and I like go out of my way not to write about like New York rap as a concept, because it really brings out the conservatism in all like my friends and foes, you know, and it's interesting. Like, you watch like what happened with like Pete Rock and Lil Yachty recently, where mm-hmm. like, and it's like Pete Rock at a certain time, like there were older folks who were like, what Pete Rock is doing is bad. What this, mm-hmm. what his music is bad. And now he's become that guy, which is absurd. And I don't even think he's like looking in the mirror to know that he's become that guy. And so because I don't want to have to write that piece over and over again, I try to stay away from it. But this summer was the first time really in years where I was like, this is worth revisiting. Mm-hmm. What is it about these artists that you think make this conversation worth having again?
I think there's a distinction to be made between New York rap or people who want to call themselves New York rappers and rappers who are from New York. Mm. And there was something about the way this year began. I mean, with All the Way Up, I was like, something's rumbling.
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
This track doesn't sound like anything I've heard in the past decade. Mm-hmm. And it felt, you know, Remy Free, like all this stuff.
Is that what did it? Remy came home? Remy came home and everything changed?
She opened the portal. I don't know. It's almost just like a sensation to me. Mm. Obviously, there are some like, you know, formal elements that mm-hmm. we can talk about, especially like with Young M.A. when it comes to her lyricism. It's very like witty, quippy, mm-hmm. quick. Like you're not getting any like verbosity that you get, you know, mm-hmm. from somebody else from a different place.
She's like Chic Looch.
Mm-hmm.
Makes
but,
me so happy.
But New Yorkers have a very intricate way of speaking. Like, you know, when we go other places, people don't understand us. And mm-hmm. it's not because of our accent. You know what I mean? People mm-hmm. don't understand us because we talk crazy. And our language is very intricate. Mm-hmm. So to be able to watch someone present that intelligibly, mm-hmm. which is really what's happening. Mm-hmm. But you understand it. It's like your own patois, your own code. You get it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that always does it, but I always reduce it down to New York records are not records you can dance to.
That's
really how it feels. That's the
point.
Sensation that you get.
Yeah.
Ooh is mm-hmm. hot, boy.
Yeah.
I feel like a traitor saying mm-hmm. it like that.
That's all right. No, that's all right. That's all
but,
right.
And yeah, it is. And it's that
our
like
faithful listeners.
That like
know
that like that side to side bounce that yeah. every New York record has, mm-hmm. like, because that's what we do. We lay up on the wall. And like the other side of New York rap that nobody ever talks about, if you want to talk about what the other rap that New York really put out there, mm-hmm. dancehall rap, that whole idea, mm-hmm. anything island inflicted is coming out of this city. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. I know there's a huge population in Boston. I'm not saying that we don't exist elsewhere, mm-hmm. but the music of it comes
it's
out
happening
of
here. Yeah.
Like we support all of that because so many of the kids here go back to the islands. I remember I used to know dancehall tracks a year before Hot 97 knew them. And I remember when radio caught up with how fast we were, when mm-hmm. radio actually started getting records straight out of Jamaica. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's the two types of New York rap. It's mm-hmm. like either like super dancey mm-hmm. for like our foreign population, or it's like, it's just hood mm-hmm. because that's how we are. And that's how you got to think about how we stand in the club, how we act in mm-hmm. the club. Like New York dudes don't really dance.
No, but this is what's interesting in having spent a lot of time thinking about
it. Think about Lean Back. It's the yeah. same
yeah,
thing
it's
as
a,
Lean
it's
Back.
It's a non-dance record. Yeah. It's like an anti-dance record or a dance anti-dance record. But listening to a lot of the A Boogie records, what's really striking to me is, you know, here's a guy who is young, you know, he's Shmurda era, playing with melodies, putting his voice in weird directions, rap singing about breakups, and yet it feels incredibly like a New York 1998 record in terms of the structure of the raps yeah. and in terms of the lingo yep. And the texture, yeah. even though he's cracking his voice. Mm-hmm. And it's like, obviously, you listen to a lot of Drake, and like, that's cool, we all mm-hmm. do, but like, there's something in the formal, like the kind of the concrete of it, that
because
was very
it's the energy
thing.
Of us, and it's the way that we talk. It's the way mm-hmm. that it's why people recognize us when we go mm-hmm. other places. It's the way that a New Yorker tells a story. If you ask a New Yorker at 8 a.m., like, what happened to you this morning? They got a story.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, I got on a train and XYZ. Mm-hmm. Like, we have a story any time of day. And because we live in a city where we interact with people at a rate that mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. almost no one else in the world does, in mm-hmm. a sense. It's like, it's not just about being crowded. It's about literally, like, the way you get to work, the way you order your food, the way you sleep yeah. at night, the way your head is out the window. Mm-hmm. Again, car culture. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like we live in a cocoon that, again, creates a language, it creates a body, the way we walk, the way mm-hmm. we talk. And so wherever you go, people always have an idea of what New York people look like right. because we're so insular.
And this is what really struck me, and this is the thing that I mentioned at the top of my piece. Like, if you think about how New York rap was in the 90s, it was so cocky, it was so arrogant. the presumption was that if you didn't sound like you were from New York, that you were doing something wrong. And I would talk to rappers from other cities, you know, from the South or London or L.A., and they'd be like, when we started, we just thought we were supposed to sound like Nas, or we thought we were supposed to sound like Public Enemy or EPMD. Like, we didn't know that we could sound our way. And then basically what happened throughout the 2000s is everybody was like, oh, no, we got this now. Like, okay, we don't have it. Like, we're good.
Virginia was like, we're here.
Yeah, we're good. Like, thank you.
Those two
thanks
people
for your
became
help.
Too iconic.
Right.
It became too iconic to sound like Nas.
Right, but also you realize that by sounding like Nas, you're denying whatever it is you grew up. Mm-hmm. You're denying your neighborhood. You're denying your history and your specificity. And that's why I thought it was funny when A Boogie is rapping, like, I'm talking to this girl in Florida, and she likes my accent. And he's like, I don't have an accent. What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And it's that weird moment of awakening where it's like, oh, like, I'm to her, I'm a regional, like, I'm not the center, like, New York is, I'm not that, like, I'm just some kid who sounds like he's from out of town.
Yeah, and it's a really, like, precious, alienating moment.
Yeah.
But that's the thing with New Yorkers, too. Like, for all this, we're also extremely sensitive, extremely permeated people. Like, when we open, like, when we open up ourselves to the world, like, we get so protective about how we are, you know, translated. And I think a lot of what we're talking about here is basically like code speaking in like certain slangs, like very, very hyper specific slangs, like specific to the block is about kind of like half disclosing. I talk about this in my piece about Young MA, you know, it's like giving people a little, but also like keeping a little bit back.
Sure.
Because the thing about our city is, for as large and rambling as it is, everybody wants to take from it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like they're always trying to take from
it.
And
there are secrets in all of these neighborhoods, in all, and this is, it was hilarious when we were driving around High Bridge, which is in the Southwest Bronx, which is, I've never been to High Bridge before. I've been in other parts of the Bronx, but never been to High Bridge. Mm-hmm. It's very isolated. There's no train that goes directly to it. You have to like take the long staircase to get to the 4 train. So basically, it's like 10 or 12 blocks long, maybe 4 blocks wide, and it's just, it's weird. It's like an island within the Bronx. And he's talking. He's like, oh, you know, we used to record here. Oh, you know, that's the old stoop. Oh, there's the bando, yada, yada, yada. And then there's one block, and we're about to turn on the block. And he's like, no. He's like, this is the hot block. We can't go on this block. And, like, basically, this is the secret. Okay, let's stop here. Let's listen to a little A Boogie. Let's listen to Bando.
Spending nights in the bando. Whoa. Told my nigga through the phone, I got something in the oven cooking up. No, that's a lingo. Whoa, if you understand the definition of a real, we can chill, we can hang. No, whoa, gotta understand that business only business. Not, no, we can't mix it up with friends though. No, this is nights in the bando. Whoa,
nights in the bando. This ice got my hands froze. Kites to the can to all of my niggas laying home.
Okay, we're back. We're back with Judnique. I'm back with Doreen. So A Boogie, he's like, you can have the rest, but like there's certain things, whether it's for psychological, legal, social, whatever reasons, it's like, no, some of this has to stay here.
Oh, absolutely. I have the girl who does my braids. I hold her very close. And I told one friend, and then my friend told other people, and the feeling I felt, I couldn't even describe it. It was like my heart was in my chest. Mm-hmm. It was like, no, like, this is my person. Like, we have a kind of connection. I mean, hair is hip hop, if we want to talk about that here. Like, there are certain, I feel like, practices or behaviors that are very Brooklyn-centric to me. You know, obviously they happen in other boroughs too, like Queens and the Bronx, where no matter what, even if my job as a journalist is to surface things and make them visible and make them, you know, form them in such a way that they can be understood, I will not tell certain stories.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's what I loved so much about what Young MA was saying when she was like, I grew up all over Brooklyn. I won't claim a single part. Like, I won't claim a certain neighborhood. I'll never claim, like, I'm Brooklyn. When people start to dig and eat into your life and start to use your narrative to tell a larger story or to interpret you on a larger scale, what's the first thing they always do? They always want to go back to the block you grew up on and see the bodega.
Where are you from?
And get all up in your stuff, but, like, not even be telling the truth. So you're like, and, you know, they formulate it all the same way. Every rapper has a, you know, where's the trap? Where's the bando? Where's the bodega? Where's the blah, blah, blah? And it's whatever. And it's like, I know that we have very mirroring childhoods in the way that we grow up, but I felt like she was keeping such a huge part of herself out of the story. Like, I still don't know that girl's real name.
Do we not know her real name?
I looked all over the internet.
I actually didn't even ask her.
And is it not out in the world?
No, it's not out in the
world. Oh, I didn't even. I actually had.
But it almost feels unnecessary, right? It's like, why would you?
I don't think anyone calls her by her real name outside of like probably her mom. Mm-hmm. But I looked up her name, and it wasn't until after I had like interviewed and she was gone, I was like, oh snap! I didn't even ask her name.
Oh, interesting.
Because I couldn't even imagine calling her anything.
Right.
MA, like what? Mm-hmm. And so it's a thing I've been thinking about, right? When you are a keeper or a gatekeeper of a culture, it is a subculture. There's always going to be a part of you, obviously, that wants it to get to a larger scale and want people to own it and to be a part of it. But what you are scared of is the fact that once you let it out into the world, it's like art, right? It becomes interpreted by others. Yeah. You can no longer control what happens.
It doesn't belong
to you, and you can't. Keeping it sub is the only way to keep it. On the other end, people who expose these things, such as, let's say, like a Vice News or whatever, in their mind,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
In their mind, they're like, oh, you want people to know about this. I have the platform to give you the voice. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is, I don't want it through your filter.
Right.
Because you don't know what to keep a secret and you don't know how to present the things that you can present. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm stuck with, I want people to know about this. But I don't need you to know more than you want to, because you're not going to go there. I don't need you to know all the secrets about East Flatbush if you're not going to live in East Flatbush.
Mm-hmm.
You just need to know the feeling and the culture and take that with you.
But this is a journalist. I mean, this is a journalist challenge, really, in any sort of, especially where power dynamics are involved. And I find increasingly, as I get older, dealing with younger and younger artists. Because, like, if I'm going to go somewhere and interview someone who's in their 30s, they know what they want to tell me.
Right.
They know what their comfort levels are. They're mature. They've been through it. They have a sense, this idea of protection versus publicizing.
Right.
They've made those choices. But you interview an 18-year-old.
I mean, look at Shmurda.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
what about Shmurda shocked anyone that grew up in Brooklyn?
Of course.
He lives on 92nd and Clarkson, bro. Like, I don't even walk that street if I can help it. Like, none of that. Everybody knew that the song was true. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew what you could look at the video and know, you know what I mean, who these kids are, where they are. I've hung out on those blocks, like, and it's like he was too young to know.
Right.
He was telling the truth because he was told that it would be his salvation in some way. But yeah, like you said, a 30-year-old person would know, like, I can't do that.
Yeah, the surveillance state, like, how is it interacting with these kids who are obsessed with the internet
and self-surveilling.
Exactly.
I mean, this is the thing. It's not in an intentional
telling
way.
Telling on yourself.
Yes, but that's really what it is. Like, basically, with the fluidity with which you can tell your own story now, the dark side of that is you are, in essence, telling these stories that for decades were private. I mean, I remember writing, like, Double XL magazine features in the late 90s or early 2000s, and you would have to dig for stuff.
Right.
Even just basic stuff you'd have to dig for because it wasn't being presented. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to ask long, you have to do longer interviews, harder questions, and like people could still decide what they want to tell you and what they don't, but you didn't have this sort of panoply of stuff to choose from.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas like with any young rapper now, I could just be like, well, on Instagram you said this. Oh, on Twitter you said this. On your Facebook you posted this. And not in a mean way, but like this is literally what your life is.
Yeah.
You've made it available. And I don't think I don't think younger generation are fully prepped for the
But also you're forgetting that technology is growing faster than the world, right? So I always say, if people knew what black people were going to do with the internet, they never would have let it happen. You know what I mean? Like if they had foreseen this, they would have been like, no way. Like if people knew that poor kids in the projects were going to have iPhones, are you crazy? Mm. Like, they would have found a different... They thought money was going to be the barrier. It turns out money is not a barrier for kids in the hood.
Right.
Like, not, you mean it is in, like, ways that can be substantial, but not in, like, getting accessories.
Right.
So it's... To me, I always think about the fact that, like, technology grew really fast, and now you have a bunch of kids that know stuff but don't really know about how the world is going to treat them because of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I had the privilege of going to all-white schools and learning what it means when to snitch on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, I know I've seen the consequences of things being recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people had me thinking about college and don't let people see you smoking weed and don't let blah blah if you want to get into an Ivy League. I was trained to do those things.
Right.
They didn't want to train me, but I was
the black kid
in the class,
you're
so they
room.
Couldn't not tell me. But I go home and my brother, who didn't go to the same schools as me, has an iPhone. They don't understand that. He's not thinking about, like, oh snap, like my boss could find me on Snapchat. Not Shout out to my brother Yael. You gonna be doing that. Shout out to Yael. On Snapchat. I'm sorry. I'm not snitching.
I'm sure he has the most precious Snapchat.
But it's just like
beams, ultralight beams Snapchat.
Nobody taught Shmurda, and why would Shmurda have any reason to think that his YouTube videos that didn't matter in May, now all of a sudden in July, got him facing 99 years.
Because your idea of interacting with the state or interacting with surveillance is very, it's tactile.
Right.
It's like you are on the street and you see a police officer coming and they touch you and they frisk you or they do whatever. That's the way you think of the police coming into your world. But they're barely doing that in a way that's like systemic anymore.
But also let's talk about how, whether it's social networks, Facebook, whatever, have been sold to us as private spaces. That's actually how they are marketed. They are marketed as, how can I connect with you, my friend? How can I connect with you, my family member? How can I share things with my intimates? It's being marketed as a place of privacy. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I mean, literally the NYPD has a gang task force that has officers dedicated to looking at these kids' social media profiles. I mean, I think maybe We Here did an article about that, but like with the Brooklyn, the kids basically, or not Shmurda's.
Yeah, right.
And so that's a real thing, and no one is sort of informing.
Absolutely.
There.
I mean, just thinking, you know, after a couple of months ago, the TI concert that got shot up, I was so disgusted and really scared to see how the video was being circulated because the video was being circulated basically to put these black bodies on display for the NYPD. And immediately, you know, you have our former police commissioner going on the radio and it's like, see, look at it. Look at what happens when rap music convenes.
And
this is what happens.
The gargoyles get together and they're like, oh, we gotta stop. Daddy said we're being bad.
We have to stop killing each other or whatever. And it's like, I think to have that happen this summer, and you know, there was a real, I mean, for years, these kinds of gatherings and concerts have been policed and patrolled.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, I don't want to make a connection that's not there, but that's how the summer started. And then the summer ended with Young M.A. on every block over and over again. It was like, we don't even need a physical structure. We don't need a club.
No.
We will turn the air into a club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So Doreen, picking back up on this idea of like Brooklyn's outdoor, informal, authentic club spaces, we're talking neighborhoods like Flatbush. We're talking Caribbean communities. We're talking dance hall. And then we're talking, as Nikki said before, we're talking almost like the two polarities of dance hall, not in terms of the music, but in terms of the rapidity of how it disseminates, which is stuff that's true to the island. I mean, there's nothing more hilarious than looking at like a Jamaican top 10 dance hall chart and then like comparing it to what you hear in like on whatever the reggae show in New York, you know, on Hot 97 is. No, it's like there's like no relate. It's like
you go to the beauty shop, it's like Soca 2012 CDs.
So it's like you might as well be listening to like the Luxembourg reggae station or something. It's like it's so strange. I remember the first time I like finally stumbled on the internet onto like the Jamaican dancehall chart, I was like, what is happening here? Like, where are these records? And then 6-9 months later, you'd be like, oh, they're okay, finally. Mm-hmm. Someone figured this out.
That's also because New York radio before 2006, when we had the summer of dancehall, when it was like you couldn't go to a party and play a hip-hop song. You couldn't play a hip-hop song at a party. Like, never mind all of that.
Right.
So it was like when we had that, the radio really wasn't trying to rep. You had Bobby Condors and Jabba, which was like the mecca of that, because they were the only 2 hours I could think of on any radio station that wasn't like a Caribbean radio station where they played music.
Right.
So a lot of that, a lot of how it looks and the difference and the giant gap between the spaces and the cultures comes from the gatekeepers really weren't messing with that because everyone, like you said, was still trying to sound very New York, very Nas, very
and
Jay.
I think it was also a population anxiety at that point. You know, we're talking about the third wave of immigrants coming to New York City. New York is a black city. Brooklyn is a black city, but it's an island city.
Yes. And there's an anxiety of how much credence do we give this?
Yeah.
Like how much lip service, how much attention, how much ear space do we give this?
And does it erase us? Because I mean,
if we give ourselves over to this, is basically New York rap or New York music, are we just going to go by the wayside? Because all of a sudden it's just going to be like, well, everybody just wants to hear Island records anyway.
Yeah, depending on the optics, if you are looking from a white frame of view, all black people just look black. But if you're in New York City, mm-hmm. you know that there are so many people mm-hmm. who have emigrated here from the islands, but who have also emigrated here from the continent. Mm-hmm. I've never really felt that Brooklyn especially was an African-American city. If anything, it felt like the representatives were. Mm-hmm. When you turned on the radio, you heard right. that accent. But actually, when you're walking around, mm-hmm. if you're walking around in Flatbush, you barely hear English, let alone all the accents in different right. patois that you actually
witness to. Do you think that's generational?
Yes.
Like, do you think like 10 years from now we will be having this conversation? It'll be like, oh, finally, the sound of New York is actually more an island sound.
I mean, it's already here now,
right? Yeah. But in terms of like the broadest yeah. of senses,
I think so. I think definitely because the global sound is going to be a big thing now, and it's coming back in a way that it didn't come before. Because even though in 2006 we had the dancehall wave, that was the first time it ever touched pop, and it didn't get pop till the very end, like. I know that doesn't seem like the end to American right, children, right. but Elephant Man and Lil Jon, there were like 4 years of hits before that.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
You know what I mean? That was like Elephant Man's like last time being on yeah. the radio in big pop culture. That was Sean Paul's last mm-hmm. big pop culture album. So that's how late stuff was. But the thing I wanted to say generationally is that it has always been an island city, but people forget that in New York, the black people and the white people that live here live in a very extreme difference. Like, even the blue-collar people that live in Brooklyn live in suburbs with, like, you know what I mean? Like, even if you go to Mill Basin and the Italians mm-hmm. and the Jews down there that are blue-collar, mm-hmm. they look hella different
from us, Bay Ridge,
all that. The white people in Brooklyn are rich, or they look rich. And the kids who live, whether you're black or island or whatever, they were living in juxtaposition of that for so long that I think we all took on that American pop culture look. And we used to, even though it was an island city, I remember when, you know, Haitians were Haitian booty scratchers, Bajans were weird kids with weird accents, Jamaicans were angry kids that talked funny. Mm-hmm. And everything about us was so different because we couldn't assimilate and we refused to assimilate. Mm-hmm. Like, when you're in a West Indian neighborhood in Brooklyn, you know where you are. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody's trying to make it American for you or whatever. And so I think that for me, I remember when I got to junior high school and high school, how the city flipped. And it was like dancehall became a cool thing, and then everybody wanted to be Jamaican, mm-hmm. and then everybody wanted to have an accent.
So we are now currently in probably what is the second big wave of dancehall, pop assimilation of dancehall. Mm-hmm. So we're talking the mid-2000s and now the mid-2010s. And I'm glad you mentioned Sean Paul before because, you know, obviously he gave an interview a few days ago where he was griping about Drake and Justin Bieber and mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And it's funny because, like, I don't, you know, we don't want to bring receipts up or anything, but I do think if you look at what Sean Paul did when he did Duddy Rock compared to the album right before Duddy Rock, I mean, this is your bed.
I was about to say
This is your like, bed, Sean Paul.
It really blew me that he was bed. When Mr. Vegas said it, it made sense to me because I was like, Mr. Vegas been giving y'all like this whole trap house thing that y'all do. That was that man's lane.
Yeah,
like, that's why the first major Laser album is literally there's a cover of a Mr. Vegas song mm-hmm. with him on it on that.
Yep,
and like they were doing a whole different thing then. It felt less like the appropriation people call it now because Diplo was kind of really putting on like. He was just doing new versions of old, really good reggae songs, whatever it may be. Okay. But I listened to that album and I liked it, and it's in rotation. And I'm an island kid, so okay. You can't tell me that it's hitting me the same way that whatever he's right. doing now because I don't listen to that.
I mean, I don't know. I remember thinking it was sus, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, but I mean, it's always sus when the white man's behind it. So that's a given. I think about that, and I think about Sean Paul coming out and saying that, and I'm like. I'm not mad that he's saying it because I do think that the dancehall artists need to fight for their space.
It's a fair conversation.
But I'm like, LOL, light skin man, you the one that's on the side
of
the record.
And for you to make yourself the face of that is, you're looking at the Hotline Bling video. It's literally your video from 10 years ago.
I'm like, if you mad that Drake is stealing your lane,
right?
Come clean and say that.
Right.
I respect it. But
those are two different things.
You can't really be mad at Drake existing because Drake exists because of you. He watched your videos growing up.
Dad, I learned it by watching you.
And I'm light-skinned like you.
Oh, hello.
But I do think, for as ornery as Sean Paul's comments came off when I read them, I thought it was representative of this problem. And it's always been a problem where somebody's like actually from this country and he's watching, I mean, Drake is not Jamaican, but for all intents and purposes, he's around this second generation group of people in Toronto.
And Toronto is a very the culture is different.
Toronto might as well be an island.
Yeah, and it's the Caribbean-ness of Toronto is actually very different, I think, than the Caribbean-ness of New York.
Exactly. Yes. It's secondary. It's like a secondary coming of this identity. Mm-hmm. And this man is having difficulty grappling with it because I also have this problem too. Like, at the end of the day, I didn't grow up in Haiti. I grew up in Brooklyn. And that's very different from somebody who's actually growing up or living in the country and producing from there.
Right.
And so I think that obviously is a valid point to bring up. But the rest of it is a little bit like, okay, Mr. Baby Boy, like, what are we talking
about? Yeah, no, that's real. And then, of course, the punchline to me in that article was somewhere towards the end. It's like, and Sean Paul is working with Blood Diamond, who's the guy who did record for Bieber. No, I don't begrudge
him.
You
should do it.
No, I know, but it's hilarious.
So it's so crazy for you to come from that space, because I didn't begrudge you that. I thought it was super cool that you worked with Beyonce. I thought we were going to take off. Like, when Baby Boy came out, I was like, that's it. The island's on the map.
Yep.
I was like, we're out of here. Beyonce, we're out of here. Because to us, Beyonce has been that for so long. But it's just weird.
But let's tie this back to what we were talking about in the first half of the conversation, which is about sort of protection versus publicity. Mm-hmm. What do you keep secret? What do you keep to yourselves? And what do you allow into the world? Is there anything about what's happening now in 2015, 2016, about this sort of pop assimilation of dancehall that feels different to you guys than the wave 10 years ago? I'll start with what I feel, which is that I feel like 10 years ago what was happening were soft island records made their way into urban stations and then urban rhythmic stations and then made their way to pop stations. So there was a sort of – maybe they weren't the truest island records, but there was a path where – basically what was recorded in a room in Jamaica more or less ended up on a radio station in New York or Chicago, basically unmolested. Whereas now it's samplable, it's an ideology, it's a sound, it's an accent that really anybody can incorporate. And you have moments like last year with the OMI record or whatever, but like, I mean, RIP OMI. but you know, like it still can theoretically happen, but even that had to go the Tropical House route to kind of get. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's the difference between the two waves, is that there was a point 10 years ago where people were like, well, I'm still going to go seek this thing out. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe what Sean Paul did on Duddy Rocky is not the hardest record, but it's made maybe in the next studio over from the hardest record, so we can pull that. Whereas now, it's like just a bunch of people who listen to Sean Paul's Duddy Rock who now are making the records. That's how it feels different to me.
I think there are a few nominal differences. First of all, one of the biggest rock stars in the world is a Caribbean woman.
Speak her name.
Sorry, Nikki. I'm sorry, Annika. But like, between Annika and Robin, like one of the two biggest stars in the world are Caribbean women. Mm-hmm. And like accent Caribbean women.
Unselfconsciously.
Yeah, like,
and very proud of
that.
And the bigger they get, the more.
What they're doing is organic pop assimilation. They are not dance hall artists. Nicki Minaj is not going to put out a Pasa Pasa mixtape, but she can do.
She can do
EDM-ish record and do a Trini Carnival video
because
that's true to her. She's not splitting hairs. That's who she is.
Mm-hmm.
Rihanna can make the biggest record of an entire year be basically like a dancehall light song, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it's true to who she is. It sounds like what it's like to be dancing with Rihanna in the club because she's a Caribbean woman. So
Shouts
for
to
me,
Party Next Door too.
For me, the huge differences are the people that are like the markers, the icons, the pop pillars of this stuff are actually originally from these places. We finally have a space for all the kids who were weird when we were listening to dance hall, who couldn't hear dance hall when we went to clubs in the city, who had to stay in Flatbush to stay in the culture, are now executives. We're at the agencies. We're the A&Rs. We're whatever the whatevers. And now when you come out with a dance hall song, you almost can't do the old way.
Yeah.
Like, one of the reasons I love that Tory Lanez love song is, and a lot of the reasons people hate it, is because I think he made it sound like 2016.
Uh-huh.
I think it sounds, to me, I love both records. And I was like, how can you make something that was such a huge part of my teens, you brought it back and it gave me the same summer feel that I love. Like that same, like, we about to go creeping in the middle of the night. I think about that, like, when you're organically doing these things, you're going to make good music. Like, people can get mad at Drake all they want, but Drake isn't forcing it. He's not. Controlla is not a forced record.
No.
One Dance is not a forced record. And yes, Drake does. He has his pulse on what's popping, but like he does those records so well because organically he is doing them.
And also, it's like, again, to talk about the sort of Caribbeanness of Toronto. I mean, this is in a way, you can almost say that Drake earned his way back towards making these. Like, if Drake had made these records 8 years ago, maybe we wouldn't know who Drake is. But because Drake took the path that he took, in the same way that Rihanna is, like, her most Bayesian, like, right now, Drake is maybe his most Toronto-ish. And now, obviously, he's not Caribbean himself, but, like, you grow
but
up around
enough. But this is the man whose first single was Find Your Love. Like, the first major single.
Yes, well, that was, well, there, yes, although, but, you
so,
know,
to me, I was like, he's been, no, but what I'm saying is he always like, shown us that he was, like, crazy. Remember that video?
Yes.
He always shows that he was obsessed with
that. Was
Mavado
in that video?
Yeah, he was always shown us that he was obsessed with island culture. But the thing that I always want to tell people is, if you lived around island people, you would know that everyone who grows up around island culture becomes obsessed with it. It is so different and so open. Island people are generally open. We want you to
and
be more, to know more about us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, there are people who, what I really want to like impress upon is how heterogeneous island culture is. It's like, you might see Nicki like put on the costume and play Mass in a video, but that doesn't mean that's the only way that one can kind of show that you have that attitude. And I feel like with Rihanna, it's interesting, like when Man Down came out, like that was my song for a year. That wasn't necessarily a hit. However, I've always seen her incorporate extremely specifically West Indian like aesthetics into her like idea of what a rock star is. And our idea of rock stars are white men. But Rihanna came in there with that like bright red weave that is something that I almost only associate with women from the islands. But she kind of like played with it a little bit and tinkered with it so that it, you know, it appeared to be in the canon of what we understand rock stars to do.
But did you feel that she was giving away too much?
No, because it was a code. So many people would have looked at that red hair and just been like, oh, that's kind of kooky. But like, I can see and I'm like, I know what you're
what you're
putting forth.
My friend looked at me, my Jamaican friend looked at me and I was like, oh my gosh, she changed her hair again. And she was like, what do you mean? She's an island woman. We change. And I was like, yeah, I change my hair color like 7 times a year or my hair or
you
that's,
get antsy.
That's a huge part of our self-expression.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm still forward to this moment to see people like Young Thug, Future, like with the Haitian flag, Kodak
Me
Black,
too.
Because of all the islands, Haiti has been ragged on the most. Nobody ever really wanted to associate with it, especially people who weren't actually from there and couldn't necessarily, like when you're from there, you can't hide that you're Haitian. You know, you can't hide your parents' accent. You can't hide these affiliations, but to see people actually drawn to them and to want to like be this thing that they aren't actually, it's just like, there's, I think that shift is happening in the mainstream culturally.
Well, and also, and Haitian, I'm sorry, and also you think about sort of the power of the Haitian community in Miami and sort of how for much of the late 2000s, early 2010s, like so much music that we all listen to was made in Miami.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of in the same way that like Jamaican-ness trickles into what happens in New York. And therefore, like I think you'd be in a studio in Miami and Haitian, Haitian identity is right around the corner. It's like even if you-
Or in the studio with you.
Yeah, sitting right there.
I mean, even you have people like Jubilee, people who make like more electronic on that level music, dance hall music and bass music, all that kind of stuff. They all around the corner was Cuba, was Haiti, was like, you know, like all those sounds are still inflicted in what they do because, again, it's organic to who you are. Like you said, like Rihanna is a Caribbean rock star. And we say this all the time, like Caribbean women, I always see on the, we're always on Twitter being like, ain't nothing Rihanna doing weird. Like, she's like the most normal human being to a Caribbean woman because everything she does makes perfect sense. Like, I love when she bought, when she was showing the Christmas gifts and she bought her mother a diamond Eucharist. And I was like, this is my mother's dream,
right? Yes. Like, don't show this to any of the older women in my family.
I was like, I can't even show this at home because they'll be like, what's Why? Really good?
Or another thing is her interactions with Drake. I see so many feminists, capital F feminists, kind of speculating on how, you know, like Drake is not supposed to take her moment and like Rihanna doesn't want to kiss him. It's like, you don't understand. That was like the height of affection I've ever seen Rihanna
she was like,
do
I'll
publicly.
Allow you.
Look how well dressed he was. She rolled her eyes at him. That's like love.
Also,
love.
She put his billboard before the show. Like, I was like, she was showing him affection before she. That's, and that was the thing that really pissed me off. And again, what we're talking about is that's what makes you so angry about a Justin Bieber or a Diplo or whatever. It's you question how organic it is. With Justin Bieber, it's not organic. Diplo fights all the time about how it's organic for him because of where he grew up. There's merit in that.
TBD.
With the Justin Bieber, like, you're like, son, like,
you didn't grow up, you're not from Toronto.
You, like, Diddy and Usher raised you. So on the Atlanta stuff, I'll give you a little bit of leeway.
Right, but also
you wouldn't grow up saying ting.
No, and look, Justin Bieber and anyone in his position is presented with records.
Right.
And maybe he's presented with a record by a person who did grow up with that, right. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Or maybe was presented by a record. Presented with a record by someone who grew up listening to Duddy Rock.
Right. But the thing is, we're no longer in the 90s where I accepted Justin Timberlake doing a dancehall track because Justin Timberlake was the cutest, hottest, right. and only guy that had the vocal mm-hmm. platform. Yep. I don't need Justin Bieber to do that anymore. Yeah. I got Rihanna. Right. I got Drake. I got Beyonce.
We are pop now.
We are pop now. So I don't need white boys doing pop dancehall anymore because... when you do it, I'm mm-hmm. gonna put you up against someone who's not sus,
right?
And you're always gonna look sus up against right. them. That's the thing that I always find funny. I'm like, we go at Drake the hardest, but if you put Drake up against all these other people that were going, he's the most authentic one. Mm-hmm. Who the only person more authentic than him is Rihanna and Nicki because mm-hmm. they, you know, like they're island women. They right. grew up in the islands, but so I just think it's very. The conversation always takes that left, and like no one's talking about how. A lot of this new island love and this island acceptance is because we're fighting the very structures of anti-blackness and white supremacy. Like, people didn't want to look like Haitians because we were the black third world country. Everybody knew us as like the slave island. Like, and now people think of us as like, oh, the Zoes, like the kind of mm-hmm. idea, the rebellious, mm-hmm. the ones that are too black, never stopped being black. Like, to me, kids in the South are wearing Haitian flags as a sign of extreme blackness.
Mm-hmm. And as a sign of reclamation of a history that their parents couldn't have.
Exactly.
There's a reason why you don't learn about the Haitian Revolution in school. This thing happened next door to America, the first free black republic in this, you know, in this hemisphere. And so I think at the end of the day, I'm always going to be happy if people who were alienated from their global family are finding that mm-hmm. connection again. But of course, if it feels inauthentic, which is to say, like, I feel like your intentions aren't right. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not actually, you know, invested in propelling the people around you who are giving you this song, mm-hmm. Sorry, Justin mm-hmm. Bieber, then I'm going to have to knock you. But it's different. Like, somebody like Drake, like, this is where he's from. And I understand it's not the original identity. It's the recombinant identity. But that doesn't mean it's any less.
It's not invalid.
Real. Yeah.
Yes.
Should we close on a Compa record?
Oh my God, you don't want that. You don't want the Haitians finding out about this podcast.
All right, we're going to go out on America's Sweethearts, Rihanna and Drake. Please recognize I'm trying, baby. It's in me after the
get done at work, come over. We just need to slow.
Thanks for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to Judnique. Thank you to Doreen. You can read them about Young MA and many other subjects. I'll put links in the blog post that goes with this podcast. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play. Check us out on Stitcher, anywhere you find your audio goodies. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. I'm your host, John Caramonica, and we will be back next week. Now you need to forward and get me out of work. It's in me up there, work. It's in me doing my da-da-da-da-da-da. Something about that work.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.